Welcome to ApplauseCast Travel. ApplauseCast, in association with Traveler's Tales, presents Larry Habiger in conversation with freelance journalist, essayist, travel writer, and novelist Pico Iyer. Considering himself a global village on two legs, Pico Iyer views the world from the perspective of a global citizen. He has contributed to publications such as Time Magazine, Harper's Magazine, Condé Nast Traveler, and the New York Review of Books, and the Los Angeles Times has called them travel writings' rightful heir to Jan Morris and Paul Thoreau. Join now Larry Habiger of Traveler's Tales in conversation with journalist, essayist, travel writer, and novelist Pico Iyer.
This is Larry Habiger with Traveler's Tales, and today we're going to be talking with Pico Iyer, essayist, traveler, novelist, travel writer, author of 7 books or more. Pico is recognized as one of the finest essayists of our time, a truly remarkable individual. His work has appeared in Time Magazine, Harper's, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, Condé Nast Traveler, and I should probably say countless other publications, because they probably are almost countless at this point. Pico, I'm delighted to be talking with you today.
Very happy to talk to you again, Larry.
Yeah, it reminds me that when I tracked you down, I was sending you emails to see if you'd be interested in chatting with us, and I found you in Dharamsala, and your email back to me said, you were next to 3 beggars, a cow, and a rabid dog. And I think in some ways that's indicative of the way you travel. You're out there seemingly on the road almost all the time. But I want to start with a question about the time that a fire burned your home to the ground in Santa Barbara. Our listeners can listen to you reading the first few pages of The Global Soul, one of your books that addresses that particular incident. But my question about that is, How do you recover? How did you recover from such a catastrophe? I mean, most of us think that we are immortal, that nothing will ever happen to us, and you know, you obviously learned that that you're not, and catastrophes do happen. So how did you adapt to that?
Well, I think I probably recovered in a not very good way, which is by pretending nothing had happened and just by resuming my life the next morning as if it was just another day in my life. And I think I had the advantage first that I'd been traveling, as you have, a lot in very, very poor countries. And I realized that even without a house and even with no possessions, here I was sitting in affluent Santa Barbara, leading a life that would be the envy of almost everyone else on the planet. And however bad my circumstances, most of the people I visited in my travels went through 10 times worse things 10 times a year. And in some ways, it just brought me closer to them. At the same time, just as it said at the end of the reading, I had gone over to Japan the previous year telling myself I wanted to live simply. I checked into a Zen temple in Kyoto, failed miserably at that, not lived simply enough, and then come back to California and through the fire got my wishes. So I couldn't really complain, because in some ways circumstances had brought me to exactly the state that I said I wanted to be in. And I think also I just was aware that my parents, who are 60 years old, in some ways it would be very difficult for them to start up again at the age of 60, and they had lost so much, 6 decades of their past. Whereas for me at age 30, it was much easier just to take it as a fresh start and at least try to use it as an opportunity to have a sort of tabula rasa and to remake myself and to remake my writing. And I won't say any more except just one example, which is that when the fire came to our house, I was in the middle of a non-fiction book on Cuba, and I'd been to Cuba, I think, 3 times in the previous 3 years, and I'd got very involved with a group of young people in Havana who were desperate to escape and to come to America as political refugees. And a bit of me had always wanted to try fiction, but I'd never had the courage to throw myself into that unknown form. Well, the day after the fire, I woke up and I was still haunted and possessed by Cuba, but I realized I had none of my notes and I couldn't begin to tell the story of the people I knew, because all the particulars were ash. But I knew that I wanted somehow to reckon with Cuba, so I thought I'll just make up some characters, make up a story, and try fiction, that the fire will have propelled me into a form that I was too scared to attempt before. And so actually, 2 years later, or a few years later, I published my my first work of fiction, and the fire somehow liberated me in a way that I wouldn't have been able to liberate myself.
That's pretty amazing. Cuba and the Night, I guess that leads me to a question. How was writing fiction, how was writing a novel about a place different from writing a nonfiction book?
I think it's almost like the difference between walking around the block and driving into the desert at night with your headlights off, which is to say that nonfiction, of course, is a much more conscious analytical exercise, and I've done quite a lot of it. So like you, I sort of know the procedure. I'll go to a place, I'll take lots and lots of notes, I'll travel around absorbing as much as I can for 2 weeks, and then I'll retreat to my desk and try to make a shape and sense of it. And I usually know how I'll begin, how I'll end, what the trajectory is. Whereas fiction is much more a matter of pitching yourself into the unknown, not knowing what's going to come around the next corner, not even knowing what's going to come out of you, and sometimes being startled by what does come out of you. And it was interesting because after I finished my novel in Cuba, at that point I'd been there 5 times on what seemed like extended visits. I made one final trip just to make sure that the blue car was really blue and the tree above the hotel in the above the swimming pool in the Hotel Capri was just where it was, and that the street called Virtudes met the street called Lascaux. And of course, when I went back on that checking trip, nothing in Cuba was the way I'd imagined. I thought I knew it very well. I'd recreated it vividly in my desk, and yet the blue car was green, and the tree wasn't as I'd remembered it, and the streets didn't intersect. And at that point, I had to decide how much to correct and how much just to say, well, this is the alternative Cuba that exists in my mind. And the only other novel I've written, which was called Abandon, and it was largely about Iran, I deliberately made a point of writing the entire book without ever having been to Iran. To this day, I've never been to Iran, although I have 40 pages in my novel describing it vividly. And it was a way of setting myself the task of trying to get at a place in a different and maybe a deeper way. I thought if I went to Iran, I would take lots of notes and I would come back and I would in some sense smuggle my non-fictional mind into this novel, and I would saturate the page with details and observations and really treat Iran as if it were a subject of a travel magazine piece. But by not going to Iran and just reconstructing it in my head through research and reading the way that historical novelists work, I thought maybe I could get something deeper in the soul of Persia, that something in the spirit of that place that has captivated people through centuries that would in fact only be obscured if I saw the Tehran of the year 2004. But your question is a really good one, because I think it's the kind that I ask myself often, which is, if I'm going to write, if I'm possessed by a place, will I write about it in fiction or nonfiction? And then secondly, if in fiction, will I even try to spend a lot of time in the place, or will I try and get at it in a different way?
Well, it's a really interesting approach, and the whole notion of writing about a place creatively without having been there, so you don't have your imagination sort of cluttered up with the realities of what you see. Did you get any feedback from readers, Iranian readers or Persian readers, people who say, gee, you described my Persia or my Iran in a certain way, and boy, you got it exactly right, or gee, we're way off the mark. Did you get any feedback from readers about that?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question, and it's an indication of really how porous and suspect the very distinctions between nonfiction and fiction are. Because when that book came out, the narrative of the book goes between back and forth between Santa Barbara, where I've lived on and off for 40 years, and Iran, to which I've never been. And of course, as you'd expect, as soon as the book came out, I think I heard a few mumblings from people in Santa Barbara who said, this is nothing like the place.
And I
didn't get any complaints from Iranians. Now, the one thing I will say is that having written 40 pages about a place that I'd never been to, after I drafted those pages, I sent them out to 2 Iranian friends. I have one in London and one in Los Angeles, and I asked them to read those pages and just make sure that I hadn't got something completely wrong. And one of them read it, and she said, it's surprising, you really seem to have got it just as I remember it. There's only one thing I noticed, which is that I have a scene in which a young boy invites a visitor up to his flat, and she said, well, actually, in modern-day Iran, no young boy would have a flat of his own. And of course, I never would have known that, but as soon as she said it, I knew she was right, and so I corrected that. And then the other friend said about one passage, well, most Iranians would be much more polite than your character. And she's absolutely right, but my character was, in fact, Spanish, so I was able to stick with that and assume that he might be a little more incautious than an Iranian would be. But so to this day, I really haven't heard. I've heard a little from Iranians saying, yes, this sounds very much like the Tehran I remember, and no complaints. But my neighbors here, among whom I've lived for 40 years, are convinced that I made up Santa Barbara that doesn't exist.
Well, after the fire, you had the license to do that, I would imagine. Well, let me ask you, Pico, regarding fiction and nonfiction, do you have a preferred form of writing? You know, you write book reviews and magazine essays and travel books and novels. Do you have one that you prefer, or do you like the change of pace, being able to mix it up?
I like the change of pace, but the form I'm really in love with at the moment is fiction, precisely because I don't know how to do it, and because it's a new medium that I haven't really figured out. And I think what I'm really saying is that I'm a traveler at heart. And by that, I mean not that I'm eager to get new stamps in my passport or not eager to see places I've never seen, because at this point I've seen lots of the countries I most want to see, except for Iran. But more that I think a traveler is someone who's always hungry for the new challenge and always wants to look around the corner to the place he hasn't been yet. And for me, that place really is the world of fiction. So I feel that having done essays and book reviews and pieces of travel, non-fictional travel, for probably 25 years now, to some extent I know my own tricks. And it's like going to a place that's your home, that you know so well that it's hard to be transformed there. Whereas fiction is still complete terra incognita, and that's why, again, it's like, as I said, venturing out into the darkness. And for that reason, it's still captivating. I think it still has a lot to teach me, that I still feel that I can be constantly surprised by what I come up with and by what the form yields to me. So left to my own devices, I'd love to keep writing fiction. The only trouble is, I'm not a very good novelist. And, I think if I did that, I'd be pleasing myself, but there wouldn't be a single reader in the world who would be enjoying it. So I still will always write nonfiction, I'm sure, because that's a form I'm more comfortable in saying, well, I have some experience in it, and I can offer the reader something. Fiction, I think, feels more private indulgence at this point.
Well, driving out into the desert with no headlights is a nice metaphor. And it seems to me, Pico, that you seem to live metaphorically. You talk about, you know, taking on the fiction and working on novels because it stretches you and gives you a new form to work in. And do you have a sense that you have a fabulous life, and fabulous in a traditional sense of fable?
Well, that's a beautiful question, and you stated it more elegantly than I could.
Oh, I stumbled all over it.
I mean, I suppose when I read that passage at the beginning of our conversation from the Global Soul, that was a slight way of saying that I was trying to turn my life into, as I say, an allegory, or you could say a fairy tale. I tend, like many nonfiction writers or classical writers of travel, not to include myself very much in my writing, except when I feel that myself can stand for a much larger body of people. And so when I wrote the piece that I read, and when I read it just now, it wasn't really because it was interesting to me that those events happened to little old Pico Iyer, one out of 6 billion people, but more because that sense of disorientation, the sense of suddenly being uprooted from your home, the sense of being an exile in your own home country and having the world swirl around you very, very quickly, is something I think that many people feel in this modern time when we have 100 million exiles in the world, and when the world has reached this kind of MTV state of acceleration, whereby even if you're sitting at home in the place you think you know, you feel displaced and jet-lagged. So that's a long way of saying when I write, I try to see myself as having, in your terms, a fabulous life. Try to see what are the stories in my life that I can make interesting and familiar to other people. I am saddled with this interesting name. My first name is actually Siddharth, which is the Buddha name. My second name is Pico, which is the name of an Italian Neoplatonist philosopher from the Renaissance. And my third name is Aya, which is a classical South Indian name. So one way or another, circumstances almost seem to have given me this perfect name for somebody who wants to fit in everywhere and to live in many, many cultures at once. So I suppose I try and look for those details in my life that tell a larger story, such as even the fact that I'm an almost exact contemporary of the phenomenon of jet lag. Somebody recently told me that jet lag was first used as a term in 1956, and I was born a few months after. And so I sort of play with the notion that my country and my direct contemporary isn't a particular nation on the earth, but it may be the country of jet lag and the phenomenon of jet travel.
Well, I love the idea of a country of jet lag, and I know that you write about that occasionally, maybe a little bit more than occasionally. And you have a wonderful essay in Sun After Dark, an essay called Night Walking, about the worlds we see when we're under the influence of jet lag. And I especially love the notion that you stay on California time and walk through the night in Manila, seeing a world, seeing the night in a way that you never see it at home. And I think the quote might be that you call the night as foreign to you as Antarctica. Can you tell me a little bit about that, a little bit about why the night is so foreign to you and what it's like living under the influence of jet lag?
Well, I like your phrase, under the influence. That's perfect, because it is like a kind of possession or drunkenness or drug. I suppose my sense is travel for me is almost like an alarm clock. The point of travel is to wake you up, to startle you into a kind of new attention, to put you into that state of heightened responsiveness where all the settings in your senses are on, and to make you see the things that you would never see in the ordinary run of things. So what I try to do when I travel is get myself into that state of intensified responsiveness, either by choosing an unusual kind of place like North Korea or Easter Island or Iceland, which I know will be so different for me that it'll force me to pay attention even to the phone book and the local McDonald's and the TV broadcasts in my hotel room, either to do that or to go into some section of daily life that I would never see. And I'm a very, you probably know as an old friend of mine, I'm a very routinized person. I go to sleep most nights at 8:30. I wake up as soon as the light comes in. I have a very strict regimented schedule. And that's, of course, completely turned on its head as soon as I'm jet-lagged. And I'm jet-lagged quite a lot. I live in Japan, but my mother now lives here in Santa Barbara. And so I come to visit her about four times a year. And that means each of those four times, when I arrive in California, for one week, I'm completely displaced. I'm writing wildly emotional letters to people I've never met. I'm sort of walking backwards down the street. I'm going out for lunch at 3 in the morning. I'm depositing $5,000 worth of checks and getting a $50 receipt back from the cashier and saying, have a nice day. I'm really not myself. It's almost as if I'm a facsimile, a blurred facsimile of myself, a ghost self. So that happens for 1 week after flying from Japan to America, to California. And then when I fly back from California to Japan, again, I'm in 1 week of displacement. So if I visit my mother four times a year, that means 8 weeks of every year, which is almost a sixth of the year, which could come to 8 or 9 years of my life, I'm in this alternative state of jet lag. And it struck me a few years ago that jet lag, that I would spend much longer in the state of jet lag than in the state of Haiti or India or Ethiopia or many of the countries I visited, and B, that unlike most foreign countries, it was completely foreign and giving me a different way of seeing the world, but I never stopped to record it or to observe the features of this landscape the way I would if I was walking around Haiti or India. So I began charting this inner landscape. And I think for me, when we talk about being moved or being transported, we're not really talking about jumbo jets or Amtrak trains. We're talking about being transformed within. And I noticed that jet lag took me as far away from my normal life as any of the places I visited. So I started to chronicle it. And just as you were saying in your question, whenever I fly back to Japan from California, because I know I'm going to be completely useless the first week in Japan, and I'll be going to sleep at 2 in the afternoon, inconveniencing everyone else in my household, and I'll be up at 3 in the morning inconveniencing them even further. Because of that, I always fly back to Japan via some other Asian city, Kuala Lumpur, Saigon, Singapore, Bangkok, Saigon, Manila, Hong Kong, Shanghai. And for the first week, while I'm in this displaced state, I just walk around these cities at night. And take somewhere like Bangkok. I've been to Bangkok, I think, more than 60 times over the last 25 years. But if I go to Bangkok in a normal run of things, I'm waking up at 6 in the morning and I'm seeing the boats on the river and going to visit the temples and doing some shopping and going back and going to sleep at 9 in the evening. If I'm jet-lagged, I'm waking up at 9 in the evening, and I'm walking through almost the subconscious of the city. It's almost like walking through the shadow side. And I see a whole city I would never see ordinarily. When I'm walking through Singapore, for example, which is, as you know, pretty regimented and orderly and law-abiding, if you're walking through the streets of Singapore at 4 in the morning, you see a different side of Singapore that you never would have guessed existed, and of course you see a different side of yourself. And so it's a way for me to force myself to look differently at the places I think I know, and to try and catch them at different angles, the way with a friend you know very well, you might suddenly try to find yourself, put that person in a different situation, and suddenly you see something else coming out. For me, in some ways, travel is about making the most of wherever you find yourself. And I don't like being jet-lagged, but given that circumstances enforce jet-lag on me, I decide to take it as an opportunity to see what I can see in that state that I would never see elsewhere. And the final thing I'll say is that all my travels around the world, in some ways, are about trying to import new eyes to my hometown of Santa Barbara. So when I go to Tibet, I'm very excited to bring America to Tibet and to see Tibet itself. But the third part of the process is that when I come back to Santa Barbara, I try to look at the things I otherwise take for granted, including the house where I'm sitting now, as a Tibetan would see it. And one nice thing that jet lag does for me is that in my own hometown, I'll go out at 4 in the morning in search of lunch, and I can smell the ocean along the fast food joints 5 minutes from my house. I'll see all the people on the graveyard shift I never see otherwise. I'll see a whole other city that I've never seen in 40 years in Santa Barbara, and that's only through being out at 4 in the morning, as I wouldn't otherwise, and being somewhat woozy, thanks to the mysterious influence of jet lag.
Well, in a funny way, it almost makes you long for being able to be up 24 hours a day so you would know your own hometown better.
Yes.
That's the kind of thing that, you know, we're all in our routines in our lives, and you know, either you're a night owl or you're a morning person or some combination, but you know, most of us don't really see the full facet of our communities and our neighborhoods and our cities. Sometimes you think, maybe I should take a vacation and just spend a lot of hours at night wandering around and seeing what there is to see and seeing how other people live.
Exactly, or even what most of us never do, which is just drive to a part of our own hometowns we never see, or just to go to those streets that you've always avoided or whatever. But again, as I said at the outset, it's just for me a way of underlining the fact that travel is much more about new eyes than new sights. And if you can somehow import new eyes, then everything looks different and new. One of my great inspirations through all my traveling life has been Henry David Thoreau. And you know, he famously said, to travel and descry new lands is just to think new thoughts and have new imaginings. It's that inner transformation that travel is about for me.
Yeah, I think that's all. I think good travel is all about inner transformation. We go places, we go to the foreign places to see something different, but not just to see what's externally different, but to see ourselves in a different light. And I think it's travel is a wonderful way to get to know yourself and to see what the world's doing.
Exactly, and I think as you were saying also before, to get to know yourself precisely because you're propelled out of the routines and the defenses behind which you usually hide. I feel that in some ways my routine, that, and as you say, we all have routines, is kind of a safety net, and I can go along for 80 days in a row and nothing surprising will happen. And what I love about travel is that it throws you into this kind of existential darkness, and you're forced to reconsider yourself and to address essential questions from which you're shielded in some ways when you're within the four walls of your routine.
That's right. Well, jumping over to writing about travel, Pico, I wanted to ask you, a lot of your travel writing focuses on the poorer regions of the world, and I'm wondering what you are trying to bring to readers by focusing on these places. Are you Are you coming at it with a definite point of view of what you want to communicate to your readers?
No, I think I'm trying to come to it actually without a definite point of view and with as much openness as I can summon, just to see how those places will correct or complement my sense of reality as I construct it here in Santa Barbara. And I think all my travels since the beginning of my career have been motivated by the sense that in some ways we live in a very unreal bubble in fortunate places like California. And when I look at the world from my vantage point here, I'm pretty confident that I'm not seeing the world as it is for most people, that I'm insulated from it, and that I'm probably encased in illusions in some ways. And I want to try to break through there. So I remember when I began my traveling life, one of the first things I did was to find the Trading with the Enemies Act of the U.S. Defense Department. And I thought I didn't want to befriend our country's enemies necessarily, but I thought these are the countries that I'll never hear about here in California and that will never hear about me. And so I went to China and North Korea and Cuba and Vietnam as they were then. Instantly, these places that were only abstractions in my head took on flesh and blood, and instantly, my sense of what I take for granted in the world was overthrown in some ways because life is so different there. Right after that, just as computers were becoming so ubiquitous and we were hearing about the information age, I thought, well, the most interesting thing I can do is to go to those countries that belong to the disinformation or the misinformation age, the places that aren't part of the grid and that will remind me of how much lies outside the grid. And so that's when I went to Bhutan and Paraguay and North Korea and other curious places like that. And then most recently, at the end of the last century, when our country was enjoying a period of prosperity, I think unprecedented in its history, I thought, here I am living in this affluent resort town of Santa Barbara in California, which is the dreamed-of destination for most people in the world, and I ought to see what real life is really like. And I always find that when I'm sitting at home, I'm confident I know everything about humanity and reality and those basic things. And the minute I travel anywhere, I realize that I don't know a thing. And so I decided I should go and see the poorest countries in different corners of the globe, such as Bolivia and Haiti in the Americas, Yemen, Ethiopia, Tibet, Cambodia, Laos, quite a few others, in the confidence that they would offer me a very different sense of what's what than California does, and at least round out my perspectives, make me less provincial. I suppose that a small part of me was thinking that the traveler can practice a kind of citizen diplomacy, can be an emissary between these poor countries and the U.S., and sometimes the distance between countries, even in this wired world, seems greater than it ever has been. And I think one thing that a traveler can do when he goes to Syria is take the Syrians a living sense of what an American looks like and bring back to Americans a living sense of what Syria's like. So part of me was thinking that, and a part of me was concerned that globalism seemed to be intensifying these distances between places. But I didn't really go with any agenda. I just figured whatever Tibet or Haiti will show me is something I can usefully bring back to my comfortable California life.
Yeah, and agenda was not exactly what I was getting at, because I assumed that you did not go with an agenda. What I think is interesting is what you're talking about is exploring these places that generally in the news you only hear about if there has been some catastrophe, and there are untold humans, fine people in all these places, and I think your writing about them in such an open and non-judgmental way allows people, readers who might choose to travel to these places or might not travel very much themselves, to get a different perspective on what the world is like and what's happening in other countries and other places, because they might be mostly familiar with the developed world, or European countries, or the United States or Canada or what have you. I think your approach is a really great service for people who are interested in the world and what's going on.
Oh, well, thank you. And I know that's what you know, Traveler's Tales is really about. And I do feel sometimes that we, all of us alive now, especially in America, are sitting on this amazing opportunity, which even our grandparents could not have imagined, which is to go to the places in the far corners of the world, which our grandparents at most could have only read about. And just as you're saying, I suppose I take quite seriously this notion of our living in a global neighborhood. And I think in any neighborhood, the first sensible thing to do is go out and meet the neighbors and find out who they are and what they think and what they feel. If you just stay at home and lock the door and draw the curtains and cower behind your chair, the neighborhood is going to seem pretty scary to you, and you're going to seem pretty scary to the neighborhood. And I think, just as you're suggesting, that's one of the great things that travelers can do at a time when, in some ways, our country is more at odds with the rest of the world than ever before, and where most people that I meet on my travels long to come to America, but will never have the chance to visit because they'll never have the time or money or freedom to come here. So I think it's to some extent up to us to initiate the dialogue with the other. And the first thing you find when you meet the other is that the other is not that different from yourself. I find when I'm sitting at home and I think about Vietnam or Cuba or Lebanon, mostly what I think about is how different it is from ourselves. If I think of Syria, I think their government is hostile to our own. They speak a language that I can't read. They observe a religion that forbids the very images that are almost holy manna here in Southern California. Nothing could be more different. And of course, as soon as I go to Syria, I'm struck by those differences. But what hits me more is all the similarities. Most of the people I meet, just as you're saying, dealing with exactly the same questions as I and my friends here in Santa Barbara. They're thinking about how they can pay for their kids to go through school, what they can do with their government, how they can make their peace with the economy. And I think when we think of places in the abstract, we think of how different we are, and as soon as we meet them in the flesh, we see how close we are. And I had one lucky opportunity just a few years ago. I suddenly found myself in southern Yemen and in the port city of Aden, in the summer of 2001, and it was the most desperate, broken place I'd ever been. No shops, no restaurants, no hotels. It had been through 30 years of civil war, and there was just rubble in the streets, really. And occasionally, when a car would stop at a red light, a sunken-cheeked old woman would come and hammer on the windows asking for some money. And as in all the difficult places in the world, the people there couldn't have been kinder to me. I mean, I was a virtual millionaire coming to California for a few days to visit them, and yet all their concern was how they could make me feel at home and how they could show me around. I remember my first day, a man came up to me and said, "Would you like me to show you around Aden?" And I said, "Yeah, please. You know, what can we see?" And he said, "Well, the cemetery. That's the only thing to see." And so I spent a long afternoon walking around the cemetery with him, and he showed me where his sisters and his mother and so many other people who'd come to Yemen had ended up. So I had this very heart-shaking and human experience in Yemen, and I came back to Santa Barbara trying to think how I could possibly put this very afflicted, impoverished, embattled country in the same sentence with comfortable California. And as I was sitting at my desk here trying to work that out, suddenly my mother came into the room and said, "Oh, do you know, two planes have just flown into the World Trade Center in New York." And suddenly, although most people in the U.S. hadn't been thinking about Yemen much at all for many years, as of September 12, 2001, Yemen was in all our broadcasts and newspaper headlines because it's the site of the home village of Osama bin Laden. And in fact, Aden, where I'd been, was the site of the previous terrorist attack on the U.S., the bombing of the USS Cole, 10 months before my visit. So suddenly everyone was talking about Yemen, and certain people were saying, "Well, it's our duty as good citizens to destroy this country of evil." And I just felt, in a small way, just by stumbling through the place as a tourist 6 weeks before, I'd seen a Yemen that I never would have learned about, even if I'd read my own pieces in Time magazine. Just getting even that small taste of the human reality somehow gave me such a different perspective from if I'd just been following the news or reading about Yemen.
Yeah, well, there's no substitute for being on the ground in a place with the
no
people
substitute.
With the people there. Pico, I wanted to ask you about the sort of one of the themes that runs through your work. You know, many of your books and essays are about the confluence of cultures and how these forces affect us.
Mm-hmm.
And really, starting with Video Night in Kathmandu, and I would say right up through Sun After Dark.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit about that? The whole way that you work with that theme. It seems to be in just about all of your writing.
Yes, and it's not a conscious thing, but I think it's probably just because it's in all of my blood and in all of my eyes. And as the reading that I began this conversation with pointed out, I just, through good fortune, I suppose, I had the chance. Both my parents are Indian. I'm 100% Indian by blood, but I was born in Oxford, England. And then when we moved to California when I was 7 years old, and so literally from the time I was 8 in the third grade, I wasn't entirely Indian because I don't speak the language there, and I've never lived there. I wasn't entirely English. I certainly don't look with my brown skin like any typical Englishman of old. I couldn't call myself American. I just had this little green card that called me a permanent alien. And at some point in my adult life, I realized that I've grown up with, in some ways, this great advantage of having a part of myself in many, many cultures, but not being stuck inside any one of them. And so I think I noticed that when I went to Yemen, for example, I probably wasn't looking at it as a typical Indian might, if such a thing exists, and not as a typical Englishman, nor as a typical American. I was bringing all these different cultures to bear to this city that itself was kind of multicultural. And I remember vividly that when I was growing up as a schoolboy in England, I was the only dark-skinned kid in all my classes. I really, really stood out. It was a rarity, and I thought quite a luxury to be sort of one multicultural mongrel in what was otherwise still quite a homogeneous society. And now, of course, when I'm walking through the streets of San Francisco or Toronto or Sydney or Hong Kong, most of the big cities in the world, half the kids I see are actually much more international than I am. I think the typical citizen of the 21st century is somebody with perhaps a Thai mother, a German father, growing up in Vancouver and now choosing to visit Guatemala or Luang Prabang in Laos or somewhere. And so it suddenly seemed to me that these people, who I think of almost as a nation unto themselves, a whole alternative parallel community, that they were living in ways that human beings had never lived before. And many of them, to some extent, like me, were able to choose what was their community and their tradition and their religion and even their sense of self. When my grandparents were born, all four of them were born in India, but not very, very long ago. And for all four of them, when they were born, the minute they were born, they were almost given their sense of, this is your religion, this is your caste, this is your place in society, these are your friends, these are your enemies, and your whole life will take place probably within a pretty small radius of where you were born. And now, in just two generations, all of that is in flux. And so I suppose I've always been interested as a writer more in the future than the past. And I think my strange background liberated me from the past, as happened again with that forest fire, but made me very curious about almost charting topographically the features of that interesting country known as the future, of which jet lag is one small corner. And I thought that these people of the new century in some ways would be children of possibility, who were living in the future as much as in the past. And it seemed like a great opportunity. For example, sometimes I think that if I were to define myself as Indian, perhaps I would think of a Pakistani person as my enemy. If I were to define myself as English, maybe members of Britain's former colonies would see me as an enemy. If I was to have called myself American in the 1960s, I would have thought of the Soviet Union or Cuba as my enemy. But I try to live outside nation states, partly in the hope that I can therefore live outside the resentments and divisions of my parents and live in this much more fluid state where I don't have a fixed sense or wall in my head of who is on my side and who is against my side. And I suppose I've written quite a bit about that just because it seems to be one of the features of the coming age, that, as I say, more and more people I see are even more and more living in this interesting possibility of being outside the fixed categories and outside the fixed definitions. And although 100 million of them are exiles and are there by necessity rather than choice, and it's very painful for them, there are others of us who are fortunate who can try to make the most of this opportunity that humans really haven't had before.
Well, it's really amazing to be in a situation where you can live outside, you know, fixed categories. And in some ways, you know, it seems that you're not only doing that. You spend about half the year or more in Japan, and then a part of the year in Santa Barbara, and then you're traveling a lot of the time. I'm wondering if you have a sense of home, a sense of where you feel rooted, or where you feel you really belong. Do you have any sense of that? I mean, do you feel Japan is home, or Santa Barbara is home, or are you pretty much happy and free and comfortable wherever you are?
I think that's a nice way of putting it, that what you just said. I think I am pretty happy and free and comfortable wherever I am, and I think just growing up with a lot of movement and going back and forth as a little boy, age 9, between my parents' home in California and my boarding school in England, in some ways made the process of movement, the passage between cultures, the airplane almost, a home. And I think was a good training in being flexible. And so when I find myself in Yemen or Haiti or Cambodia, in some ways they seem no more alien than England or California or India would be. And I think one interesting aspect of this new group of people that I've described is that for more and more people, home is invisible and portable almost. We carry our homes around us with us the way slaves, snails do. Just as I was describing in the sequence about the forest fire, the day after the fire, if somebody had asked me the question you just did, I literally couldn't point to any physical construction in the world. There was no piece of soil that represented my home. My home would really have to be just the loyalties and affiliations and friendships that I carry around with me everywhere I go. And I think my home is in that sense always inside me. I sometimes think that my home is the English language, because that's the one companion that's kept me company literally every breath of my life for all my years. And Japan is a kind of home in a mysterious way. I don't speak much Japanese. I don't eat Japanese food. Of course, I don't wear Japanese clothes. And yet, it makes sense to me in the way that sometimes at a crowded party, you can see somebody and feel that you've known that person forever. And that's how I feel with Japan. And I think all of us have some kind of connection of that sort with some place that strikes a mysterious chord in us. So I'd be happy to claim Japan as my home. But maybe that's because I'm an outsider in Japan, and the Japanese would certainly be happy never to claim me as one of them. And so it's a good place for somebody who's used to being on the sidelines, because it is quite an exclusionist place. And I love Japan, but I could never really be a member of the society or never accept it as one of the locals there.
It's hard to integrate there.
Very.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a question, Pico, now that might actually seem like a silly question, because we've been around the subject a lot already. But I'm wondering how your life of travel has shaped you. And another way to say this is, how is the Pico Iyer of Video Night in Kathmandu different from the Pico Iyer of just after Sun After Dark?
Well, it's such a good, straightforward question. I'm not sure anyone's ever asked me that before. But I think in some ways I've been traveling almost since I was born, as I was just saying. And so travel has been my home country. And travel has been the language that I speak. Movement is my second nature. In some ways, that's my home. And so in some ways I think I've been shaped almost entirely by this process of moving between cultures. I think it maybe has meant that I'm not very good at settling down, and I'm not good at being part of a community or family or a nation, but I am good at moving between them. There's a line in the Diamond Sutra, the Buddhist text, that says, develop a mind that delights nowhere. And I think in some ways I haven't had to develop it, because circumstances have given me this ability to one day see the world through the eyes of a Syrian, and 2 weeks later see the world through the eyes of somebody in Washington, which can be a liability. But I think the other way that travel has shaped me is to try to move me to make the most of wherever I find myself, and to try to see that everything is an opportunity in disguise, if only you can make your eyes acknowledge that. I'm just completing at the moment a book on the 14th Dalai Lama, whom I've been lucky enough to know really since I was a small kid. And one of the things I find invigorating and liberating about him is that he'll take something like exile, for example, which most Tibetans and most people see as a matter of suffering and loss, And he will see it as an opportunity. He'll say, well, we've lost the old Tibet, and this is, in fact, a great chance for us to make a new Tibet, to be free of the ritualism and some of the suffocating stuff of the old Tibet, to make a new, improved Tibet 2.1 in some ways, to slough off what we didn't like about our home and to construct a different, more modern and more international home. And so that kind of example has always been with me, in the sense of moving me to, I suppose, to see the glass as half full rather than half empty. I know many people who grew up between homes, for example, the writer V.S. Naipaul, seem to feel displaced everywhere and estranged everywhere. And wherever they go, they can't find a home. And I think it's almost a matter of temperament. I grew up in very similar circumstances, and the way I see it, everywhere I go, I do find a home. Everywhere is equally home. And I've never had the advantage of being able to say I'm 100% American or 100% British or whatever, but I turn that into the advantage of saying that I can be a bit of many things. And in fact, that's the way that the world is turning. And so in some ways, as I think about these issues in myself, I find that I'm addressing the same issues that whole countries and communities are facing, because all the world is a multicultural mongrel at this point. And most of our great cities are just like me. They have a piece of England over here and a piece of India over here and American influences over there. And they're trying to see how they can take these scattered pieces and turn them all almost into a stained glass whole. So I think I'm just lucky that my circumstances have paralleled and reflected those of many of the cities in the world. And I suppose that means that I'm going to be a traveler for life. I mean, as you said, I spend 8 months of the year nowadays in Japan. And actually, when I'm in Japan, stillness is my companion. I don't have a car. I don't even have a bicycle or a motorbike. I don't have newspapers or television that I can understand. I've never been on the World Wide Web. So I live really almost in a monastery there, just within four blocks of just as far as my little feet will take me. And for months on end, I don't speak English and I don't leave that neighborhood. So that is a fairly extreme form of fixity. And then, as you were saying, the rest of the time, I'm traveling. And I think what I try to do is just keep the balance between movement and stillness. I think movement is only as good as the stillness that underwrites it. We've all met traveling people who travel and travel for years at a time, and it's easy to feel that they've lost some center or lost some sense of orientation. Traveling itself has become a habit, and they're traveling for lack of anything better to do. And then we've also met people who, one way or another, unfortunately, are stuck in certain circumstances. So I think, well, I'm lucky enough to be able to choose my life, and to some extent, I've always had movement in it, but I think I can only make sense of that movement by being very, very still for much of the year.
Well, that makes complete sense to me. And you know, we are extremely privileged to be able to have the choice to travel. Most of the world doesn't have that choice. I know that you spend a lot of time when you're in California in a monastery or a retreat. So it sounds like you get a fair amount of that quiet balance in your life, especially if you're in Japan for 8 months and as you say, barely leaving your four-block neighborhood, and then having some time in California to do the same. But I want to take a step back to the Dalai Lama. You mentioned that you've known him since you were very small, and there aren't very many people, I imagine, who can make that statement. I'm just wondering if he has been a particularly strong influence on you in your life, or if he was just sort of like an uncle. Was he just one of the family?
Always been very, very kind to me, but of course he's very, very kind to everyone he meets, and he remembers everyone he meets, even though that number's in the millions at this point. But I think in some ways the way this came about was that when he came out into exile in India in 1959, I was living with my parents in Oxford, England, but my father was interested in Buddhism, and he was, I think, one of the relatively few people who suddenly realized what a treasure had come out into the wider world, really for the first time in history. So my father went to meet the Dalai Lama in 1960, at a time when not so many people were knocking on his door. And he told the Dalai Lama about having this three-year-old little boy in Oxford, and the Dalai Lama sent a picture for me of himself when he was on the throne in Lhasa at the age of five. And so I actually had this picture of the 5-year-old Dalai Lama on the throne of Tibet all on my desk all the time I was growing up. In fact, all the time until the fire took it away. And I suppose it was always handy if I was feeling the woes of the world and all the restlessness that a typical 9-year-old feels and the weightedness that the 9-year-old feels, to look at this picture and realize that there was somebody who was actually ruler of his people and a monk at the age of 5 and had unimaginable things to worry about, and that I had it lucky by comparison. So I think I have been lucky in that at a time when many people had barely heard of the Dalai Lama and he hadn't begun to travel around the world, I'd already met him and visited him in Dharamsala when I was 17, and he was already this very benign presence in my life and in my mind. And that's one reason why as soon as Tibet was opened up to the world in 1984, I went there in 1985, and there was this exhilarating sense of mutual discovery. The world finally getting to see this country that was known as the Forbidden Kingdom and that had been seen by fewer than 2,000 Westerners in all its history when my parents were growing up, and the Tibetans just as excited for the first time really to see the outside world. So I think that connection with the Dalai Lama planted a seed in my head, and I suppose I've always thought of him as an extremely kindly godfather. But I think what's more exciting is that he's become kindly godfather to literally so many people around the world. And at the time, I remember even in the early 80s, he would come to New York and hold a press conference, and I would go to it, and there'd be maybe 4 people, 3 of whom were Tibetan. And I think I never could have imagined then, nor perhaps even could he, that because of global communications and the acceleration of the world, within maybe 10 years of that moment, he was among the most recognized and respected and beloved people in the world. And again, it's an example of what we were talking about before, of globalism has brought so many pressures and difficulties to the world, but it's also brought certain blessings. And sometimes I think I complain that it's brought Starbucks and Nike and McDonald's and MTV to every last corner of the world. Usually the people in those last corners are delighted to have them. But the other thing, aspect of globalism, is that it's brought Bono and the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu and Vaclav Havel and all these great presences to our neighborhood in a way that they never would have been in our neighborhood before. And so, again, I'm charting the life of the Dalai Lama partly to look at the potential of this particular moment, where suddenly a Tibetan can be seen as our neighbor and part of our local community, as never happened before. And he has seen that opportunity and really tried to make the most of it and work with it.
Well, he's quite an amazing individual. And you're writing a book about him, Pico?
Yes, just a small book of looking, I suppose, at how he is moving us to think about the fundamental things in different ways, how we can think of politics differently, globalism differently, even celebrity and the media differently. And just because he's not taking Buddhism or the Tibetan cause around the world, but just taking basic human ideas about transformation and kindness and responsibility, I think potentially he's giving us tools with which any one of us, whether we're Catholic or agnostic or Buddhist or even hostile to Buddhism, any one of us can take these tools and somehow learn how to look at the world differently. And by looking at the world differently, make a somewhat different world. It's hard to justify yet another book on the Dalai Lama because there are so many very, very good books there already. But I guess I thought, and it goes back to your question, that I've been lucky enough to know him for a long time and to have exposure to him at a time when he was not well known and one really could spend quite a lot of time with him. And that maybe one of the better things I could do for 2 or 3 years of my life is first to think about what that example and inspiration has meant and really to think it through, devote months on end to working out how it could make me act or think or feel differently. And to just look to the future and to a time when 50 years from now he'll just be a name in a book and just perhaps at most a grandmother's memory. But how potentially could he offer something to that person 50 years from now that would make her life better?
And I would expect that there will be lots of people interested to read what you have to say about that. So I think it's a good thing.
Okay, good. Well, I've got one read in you.
Absolutely, you do. I want to ask you just a couple more questions, Pico. You've been here with us for quite a long time today, and I really appreciate all the time you're taking. I want to get into a little bit about, you know, sort of the practicalities of what you do. How do you go about your business when you're traveling? And how, you know, basically, how do you record your observations? And then what is your writing process once you've sat down to work on the essay or the book that you're going to write?
I tend, before I take a trip or before I start an article, to map things out pretty carefully in advance, confident that as soon as I'm in the place or in the article, I'll get completely lost. But by mapping it out in advance and by making an itinerary or an outline, I have the confidence in some ways that allows me to get lost. So what I'll do, for example, I'm going to Sri Lanka 3 weeks from now, and I've never been there before. So what I've been doing is reading the Lonely Planet guide quite a bit, so I have a sense of, I'll make a rough itinerary of what I'll, how I plan to spend my 2 weeks there. I'll draw a lot on the reading. I feel like I've been living in Sri Lanka for years and years through reading D.H. Lawrence and Paul Bowles and Leonard Woolf and Michael Ondaatje and many of the great Sri Lankan novelists at the moment, Michel de Kretser, who used to work for Lonely Planet, Ramesh Ganeshekara, many, many Sri Lankan writers I've been following a long time. So I'm revisiting their books. I'm trying to get hold, as I always do, you know, any Traveler's Tales volumes, which I think is almost the best way to get a feel for what, for most of the countries that I would visit. And so already I have some sense of the theme that I'll be looking for, which has to do with, I suppose, again, with religious division and the idea of paradise. And I suppose in Sri Lanka, the ideas of competing paradises. And that way, Sri Lanka is like a model of the 21st century globe with lots of different groups, each with its exclusive sense of what Eden should look like. And so having got a few ideas and having worked out roughly where I want to see, I'll go to Sri Lanka 3 weeks from now, and probably within an hour of getting there, I'll find all my ideas were crazy and abstract and have nothing to do with the reality, and I'll be taken in a completely different direction. But by saying that I'm going to spend my first 2 days in Colombo and then my next 4 days in Kandy, in some ways I'm allowing myself to walk down an alleyway and follow a scent or a trail or an intimation and end up somewhere where I never expected at all, because I have that illusion of an itinerary I'm following. When I'm there, I will take voluminous notes. And by notes, I don't mean fragments. I mean fully paragraphed mini essays, almost as if I were writing a blog or writing an essay for a magazine. So as I walk around Sri Lanka, I'll always have a pen and a notebook in my hand. And I'm lucky, I grew up in the pre-computer and pre-typewriter era, so I'm used to doing everything by hand. So I'll take lots and lots of notes as I walk the streets, and then while I'm in my hotel room that evening, I'll write them up as six-page essays, say, on my first day in Colombo, while I can still taste and feel and smell the places I've seen. And I'm a great believer in taking things down instantly, because I think experience fades much more quickly than we often imagine. And it's, again, just like a dream. And sometimes we'll wake up in the middle of the night, in the middle of a vivid dream, and if we write it down then and there, we can remember a whole page's worth. If we wait till the next morning, we can barely remember we even had a dream. So I'll take down as much as I can while I'm in Sri Lanka in this illegible scroll that even I can't read. And I think some of my most inspired word choices come from misreading my own handwriting. And I'll assemble dozens of pages during my 2 weeks there. And then I will go back to my desk in Japan and I suppose read over my notes again and again with a view to trying to see which theme has spoken most strongly to me. And I will have a sense, I'll ask a question of Sri Lanka. Almost every place I visit, I ask a question of, in the hope that that initial question will lead to a deeper question and a still deeper question, and finally to a question that can't be answered. But the question gives a kind of structure to the trip and to the writing. And then around that question, I'll start framing a tentative answer or even an argument, a provocative argument about Sri Lanka and its relation to paradise and religious division. And then I will write my piece, in this case, in the first couple of weeks after I get back from Sri Lanka. Sometimes, to shake myself up and to force myself to write in different ways, What I've been doing recently is taking lots and lots of notes in just the way I described. But when I get back to my home, I'll put the notes on the far side of the room, not look at them, wait for a couple of months, and then wait to see what memory has sifted. And I think it was you who once told me memorably, and I've stolen it from you, how memory can be one of the best editors. And so if I can wait for 2 months and then ask myself, what has Sri Lanka given to me, then I'll suddenly know what it is that is the most important thing that I've taken from the trip. And then I will follow that trail of memory and imagination and write a piece based on that, and only turn to my notes if I need to know whether it was May 26th or May 27th, or whether the car was green or the car was yellow, but mostly write from something inside myself. So I've been doing that more recently, more in the form of, I suppose, inner exploration. But in this particular case, I don't have the luxury because I have to deliver a piece to a magazine quite quickly. So I'll just work with the notes and try to see the structure that's hiding out in the notes or crying to be acknowledged, and read the notes till suddenly I see what it is that really struck me and that fitted into the pattern of other things that I've been thinking about. And one thing I always find when I read my notes is that first moment of encounter with any person or any place is, of course, disproportionately significant. I'll come back from 2 weeks in Sri Lanka and I'll read my 80 pages or 120 pages of notes, but almost certainly the most vivid and alive will be describing my first night there or the trip in from the airport. And after the first day, preconceptions will start to form and I'll start to fall into habits and routines of my own, and I'll start to place every new piece of information within the ideas I'm already constructing. But the very first impression is the one I suppose I most trust and use most.
And I'm sure what will end up being published will be a wonderful essay in a magazine, and then you'll probably develop that essay for later publication in one of your books and make it deeper and richer and even more interesting.
Exactly. That's just what I've been doing in recent years, which is to say I need the sponsorship of a magazine to afford to get me over to a place and to pay for the flight and the journey. And then I will give a piece to the magazine and then, just as you say, usually write a very different piece for myself, aimed at a very different kind of reader and the kind of reader who would pick up a book and not a magazine. So that's been my way of trying to balance the basic financial necessities of living as a writer, which is very, very difficult, and where one's still having to hustle for assignments. Even though I've been doing this for 25 years, I'm permanently having to write articles just to pay the bills. To balance that with the much more fulfilling thing of really trying to go to places in yourself and in the world that you would never otherwise see.
Well, you've made a great contribution to the world of letters and the world of travel and travel writing. And those readers who know you, know your work, really respect you and admire you, and I'm one of them. So I want to thank you for that. And Pico, I'm going to give you an impossible question as a final question. We only have a minute or two left here. But I'd like you to tell me, if you could pick three books to recommend to readers, what would they be?
The first I'll choose is The Quiet American by Graham Greene, which is my private personal Bible. I probably read it every year. I carry it around with me wherever I go. And apart from anything, it was written about, of course, an American, an Englishman, and a Vietnamese woman in the early 1950s. But I think it still says so much about the romance of the other, about the interaction between Western colonial powers and an Eastern country, about America's involvement in the war in the world versus Europe's very different kind of involvement. Somehow, whatever the circumstances of the world are, The Quiet American speaks to them, and I think more it speaks to those powerful friendships that we make in foreign places that we don't know quite what to do with. And I think Graham Greene has done that as well as anyone else. While I'm on the Graham Greene vein, maybe my second book would be Somerset Maugham's The Gentleman in the Parlour, which is, I think, a wonderful travel book about wandering around Southeast Asia in the 1920s. And 80 years on, it's still one of the best books to read on Southeast Asia, which is the mark of a good travel book, one that exists out of time and out of place. And maybe the third book is a much too conventional choice, but just to give a framework and a sense of the celestial pattern and the heavens behind our moment-to-moment encounters, maybe I'd choose Moby Dick, which I suppose is still my other favorite novel. And I think I, as a traveler and somebody who writes about travel, always am very grateful to have novelists in my company because they're looking at the same places I'm looking at, but with a much vaster eye and a much grander perspective. And so any place that I'm writing about, I think I could read Moby Dick and Melville would be teaching me about it.
That's wonderful. Three great choices. Well, we're going to sign off now, Pico. I really want to thank you, and I really appreciate all the time you took with us today. And I know that our listeners will really appreciate hearing what you had to say about writing and the world and your work. And maybe we can get you on the World Wide Web sometime so you can actually hear this interview.
That would be a revelation. Yes, I know. I'm so adventurous in some ways and so unadventurous in others. And the one thing I'll say just as we part is you've been so kind with all your compliments. And if it doesn't sound too disingenuous, I'd just like to thank you and O'Reilly Associates and all your colleagues for putting out the Traveler's Tales books because they've given so much to so many travelers in so many places. And as I sit in my bedroom here in Santa Barbara, I look on a shelf and it seems to be one unbroken row of Traveler's Tales volumes. So thank you too.
Well, thank you for the compliment, and we appreciate your support, Pico.
Thanks, Larry.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope to catch up with you again soon, and I'll look forward to reading your piece on Sri Lanka wherever it will appear, and your next book, of course.
Thank you.
Okay, Pico, take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to leave us email regarding tonight's podcast, drop us a line at ontheair@applausecast.com. If you'd like to have ApplauseCast produce a podcast for you or your organization, email us at sales@applausecast.com or call us at 650-400-3929. This has been an ApplauseCast production.